fisherman said, you're not right. Now I'm staying up all night.
Hey friends, it's the Crow Boys. Our debut album, Made to Wonder, is out now.
Download and stream it wherever you listen to music.
Hey everyone, this is Ismay, musician, host, and creator of Finding Lucinda. In anticipation of our documentary film coming out this fall, I've put together an in-depth companion podcast. It delves into the origins and artistry of legendary singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. New episodes are out every other week on the BGS Podcast Network. So join me on this creative journey.
Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. I'm your host, Cindy Howes. Hello! Okay, we have been doing a reissue series for the past, 6 weeks. This is our last episode today where we've been digging back into the archives and reposting. This episode, featuring separate interviews of the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emily Saliers. But we'll get to that in just a minute. But before we do, have you signed up for Basic Folk's newsletter? It's a once-a-month email that lets you know what's going on with the podcast. You can sign up for it at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media. We're at Basic Folk Pod. All of the links, again, are in the show notes, but we are on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And we're listener supported. You can make a contribution and help with the production costs at basicfolk.com/donate. And I'll tell you what, that link is in the show notes. Back in 2019, my now wife and I attended the inaugural Girls Just Want a Weekend in Cancun, Mexico, which featured an all-women lineup curated and hosted by Brandi Carlile. I was lucky enough to be able to interview the Indigo Girls in two separate solo interviews. I still feel nervous thinking about the scene of talking to both Amy Ray and Emily Saliers in each of their hotel suites, which were very nice, on my new little Shure microphone. That's a brand of microphone, Shure, that attached to my iPhone. But lucky for me, both Amy and Emily were completely charmed by my brand new little mic, so it served as the best possible icebreaker. Each of them were very generous with their time and with their answers to my unorthodox questions. So first, I'll set up this Amy Ray interview. I got to speak to Amy, who talked about growing up in a conservative, modest Southern family with a highly skilled radiologist father and a smart, scholarship-attaining mother. She talks about how her suburban upbringing and intake of conservative values of the South has influenced her identity. She shares about her father's hobbies and his deep involvement in community service, emphasizing the importance of giving back and the impact of how her father's generosity has impacted her own activism. I also got to ask Amy about her sense of fashion and how it challenges traditional gender norms. She talks about her love of creating clothing and that her historically unconventional approach to style serves as a form of activism. There was this weird technical issue in where my recording caused me to not capture or record my first question to Amy. So I'll set this question up and then we'll get into our conversation with Amy Ray of Indigo Girls. And then immediately following, we'll get into the conversation with Emily. So my first question to Amy Ray: you are so deeply rooted in the South, which I would find a struggle as a liberal gay person. But Amy Ray, you have remained. Can you talk about that complicated connection there?
I'm not, I grew up in a really just regular suburban kind of environment, and my dad was a doctor. He had kind of pulled himself up by his bootstraps and was in the Navy and they paid for his medical school. My mom went to Emory University and she on a scholarship. She was from a very poor family, but she got a full scholarship because she's really smart. and met my dad there. They got married and they went to Guam in the Philippines and had my sisters and came back. And by the time that I was born, it was like he was finishing paying off his loans. And by the time I was five, we had moved out of a house where we all were in, all the kids were in one room together, to a house that was just like a suburban house, you know, across from the high school.
Wait, how old were you when that happened?
I moved when I was six. So I lived from that house from 1 to 5. And
so
then,
how many siblings do you have?
So I shared a room with my two sisters and my little brother after he was born. And then we moved out of that. That's what everybody did, though. This was like the 60s. You know, when you were when at your starter home, all the kids shared a room, and then you moved, you finished paying off your loans, and you moved into a bigger house, you know?
Yeah.
Like when you're a child of a doctor. So then I just grew up normal, like really. My dad's and mom were like, but super conservative and very thrifty people. And so we didn't have like an extravagant life at all. I mean, we didn't know that we had money, basically. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I grew up very like public school, you know, very modest kind of life. And
what kind of doctor was your dad?
Radiologist. Yeah. He was more of a, he just chose a medical field where he would have enough time to do his hobbies. So he felt like
that. What were his hobbies?
Flying a remote control airplane, building things, chemistry, building anything. He could build anything. He could build a radio. He could build a bookshelf. He could build a boat. He could build a car. I mean, just like he was just a man of many talents. And he didn't really want to work, but he was really smart. And he just chose, like, I chose radiology because I didn't think I'd be as busy. And I didn't think I'd be on call as much, right? You know, it's so funny. It's so practical, right? Because he really wanted to be a chemistry professor. But he didn't, he wasn't, he knew he wouldn't make enough money. Mm. And he had grown up so poor. And he was like, I'm just going to provide for my family, you know. So anyway, that's kind of that whole thing. But my dad's passed away now. But they were really conservative. We went to church, like, all the time. And I loved it. I loved church. And I went a lot. I went to Bible school and youth group and choir and Wednesday night supper. And I just really loved it. And then when I was about 18 or so, and just went off to college, I still kept going, but not as much.
Mm-hmm.
And, coinciding with probably my coming out and everything too. So yeah, but it was very like kind of a conservative upbringing and, but with an emphasis on community service. My parents are really generous people, but they were conservative, you know, so it was kind of like a thing. But they were really into like tithing and giving back to your community. And my dad was always giving everybody money and sending other people's kids to college and support, you know, basically like was the patriarch of like my whole family and all my cousins. And there were a lot of rough times with his siblings and my mom's siblings. And so he kind of spread his wealth out to everybody, which is kind of how I learned basically just to be an activist, I guess, but in my own, on my own terms, really.
So we only have so much time. So I'm going to get all the good questions in. So I wanted to talk to you about the Confederate flag.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The South Confederate flag.
So,
okay.
So I mentioned earlier, I'm from suburban Massachusetts. It's a town called Walpole. And our local sports team is the Rebels. I don't live there anymore. But they used to, like, up until when my brother went to high school in, like, the early 90s, they used a Confederate flag on the uniforms, and Dixie was like the fight song. And like, that's not the case anymore. But right, there's still this like kind of weird allegiance to that mentality in a town that's like 20 miles south of Boston. So I wanted to know what it's like around you in northern Georgia, and how do you feel about like the Confederate flag and why people won't let that symbol go?
You know, it's kind of, it's a weird thing because it's in like your DNA and stuff. And if you're a white person and sometimes if you're African American too, and you grew up in the South, it's a weird thing where it's just ingrained. And, you know, when you talk about the war in the South, you're not talking about Vietnam or World War I or World War II or Korea. You know that everybody's talking about Civil War. Mm. It's like still the thing that like sits in everybody's brain.
Yeah.
And even me, I don't, you know, who knows why, but we grew up with the Confederate flag being like just part of your life, you know, and your t-shirts and Lynyrd Skynyrd and Allman Brothers. And it was all like this, and you didn't associate it with anything hateful. You thought it was a prideful, like a pride symbol of being Southern. And then as you get older, you learn the history of it and what it means. And, you know, you learn about Reconstruction and you learn about, you know, everything that happened after the Civil War and in early 1900s and 1920s and 30s, and bringing back all the Confederate symbols and stuff to, like, as a reaction against what they thought when the Black communities were getting more power and sort of learning how to work the system to benefit them, work in a good way. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. So, you know, we learned that, and then we had to, like, come to terms with it and divorce ourselves from that, the people that knew that it was the right thing to do. But even for someone like me, that was hard to do. And I'm, like, as left-wing as you can get, you know, like, and I even had a hard time, not with getting rid of the flag, but when people talk about, you know, monuments or the carving on Stone Mountain going away or whatever, there's a part of me that just, like the history of the South, I'm such a history buff that I'm just like, do we really want to? I know it's the right thing to do, of course, because I've read like every book I can get my hands on about the civil rights movement and the history of everything about racism. But I'm just like, I know if inside me there's something, then I know that the people that are around me that don't even care about that kind of stuff really don't care about reading a bunch of books or educating themselves. They just want to be where they are, you know? Mm-hmm. And so for them, it's like a thing where they feel like it's taking their pride away, or it's like a way of, it's like goes back to the carpetbaggers, you know, it's like Yankees coming down to tell us what to do, because it's like, you have to approach it the right way, because the, you know, white South that's conservative and maybe reactionary and racist, they don't like that thing that, where they feel that they're fetishized for being dumb and not knowing, you know, how to write or talk or anything. And so they kind of bristle at any person that comes to them and tells them what to do. And that's going to include something about the Confederate flag. So you really have to, like, look at it. You have to look at it differently and, like, realize, like, we need to, like, understand where these folks are coming from and work from that perspective to get rid of these symbols and these monuments, because they have feel that, you know, they have a legacy in their minds and their family's minds of being beaten down, like Gone with the Wind, you know, and they think their land was taken from them, and they think that they were, you know, punished for being white Southerners and losing the war. I mean, it's still in people's, like, family histories. And so they can't let go of this, you know, and it's like, for me, you know, my friends that are in that situation, I just try to look at it like, just, you know, think about, like, Hitler. Think about, you know, if you were Jewish and you had, you know, swastika flags in everybody's front yards. I mean, that's weird.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's yeah, just yeah. like weird, right?
Totally.
And
weird.
Like, that's just what this is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a hateful symbol. And so look inside your better self, you know, and try to confront that, because it's not going to happen if a bunch of people from outside come in and tell everybody what to do. It's going to happen when people realize truly inside their hearts what it means, you know, or have a friend who's Black and they talk and the dialogue creates this moment of like, oh yeah, this is, if this means all these bad things to you, I don't want to have it in my front yard.
Right.
You know, but people that hang on so tight, it can be crazy. I mean, it can all come down to that for people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, all the Confederate flags on those uniforms are all gone, but next to the high school in my hometown, this guy just refuses to let it go, and he put up a giant Confederate flag billboard, like, right
really?
By the football field. Yeah. It's pretty bad.
It's like, but that's just like, that's like, that is, the flag is just like this, it's a placeholder for what he really means, which is like, I don't want anybody to control me or tell me what to do. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that it's not even about the flag at that point. It's just about stubbornness.
Right.
And wanting to be respected.
Can't we just get a new symbol that means stubbornness?
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
Picture of that guy on a
flag. I mean, it's to me, it's like, I find it to be crazy too. But you know, the South, the beautiful things about the South are that it's like, because it's had all these troubles, it's the birthplace of the civil rights movement. And it's the birthplace of spirituality and faith-based civil rights. You know, it's the birthplace of activism that's rooted in a belief in something greater than ourselves. And it's the birthplace of art and activism going together, you know. And so it's like a, and the land is beautiful, and people, you know, who have grown up with that land and understand the, what that is as part of the fabric of their life. It's, there's nothing like it. Mm. So there's all these great things, and you can't, you know, I think it's like, it's hard. I think I'm white, so I have a lot of privilege in that. And so it's easy for me to say, I just want to stay here and I never want to leave. It'd be different for me if I was, you know, black and gay and, you know, trying to like, and I didn't have like a career that gave me resources and I was trying to live in North Georgia where I live. It'd be different. Because I know people that are in that position, and it's harder and it's dangerous sometimes. So my feeling is I'd stay where I stay because I want to change it, you know, and I'm in a position to change it more than some other people are because I have some safety, right? So I just try to, like, in my town, I try to do as many benefits as I can. I never play any money gigs in my town. Every gig I play in my town, all the money goes to something.
That's great.
Right? And what that does is it starts building all these connections. So if I go play at the Baptist church where they typically hate gay people, at the one in my town, they're very conservative. But I do a homeless benefit for them at their church for their organization. It's hard for them to be as hateful anymore. They have to give me a little bit of,
right.
You know, they have to give it to me, you know, and the same with my daughter's dad who grew up in the town. His whole family is like from the area I'm in. So he's gay and he has just never let anything stop him. Right. Cause he's like a white man with a good job, a CFO, and he's got a lot of privilege. So he's like, I'm going to use that. So he assumes the best about everybody. Right. He works at the, like, on Thanksgiving, he serves the meals. He's like constantly doing like all these things for the community helping place where we have like a, and the women's battered shelter. We have a lot of good little things going on in my town, and he works on all of them, right? Because that's, you know, then he's building his, he's being an ambassador for gay people. Mm. So that's just kind of how we look at it in my town, which is like the small little group of liberal people are just inserting themselves into everything we can. And not in a judgmental way either. Like, you know, we don't, you know, you don't judge people. You just,
it's like a PR campaign.
Well, in a way, but we really mean it.
Yeah,
it's not
totally
propaganda.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, we want to be part of the community and we want the community to respect us. We have to earn it.
Mm-hmm.
Period. That's reality.
So,
you know,
yeah. So to completely change directions, I was wondering if we could talk about your fashion, your clothes, so, which might seem like kind of a weird pivot, but you, to me, you've always seemed like a incredibly sharp dresser.
Really?
Like, yeah, totally. Like it's
up seems, today.
Well, we're in Mexico. So, yeah. I mean, your image is part of the Indigo Girls and your solo career. Like, I felt like your image, your fashion image in particular, showed that there's more than one way to dress as a woman. And even though it seems like kind of a frivolous thing, what has been your relationship to fashion? And do you think you've used it as part of your activism?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's, you know, it's gender. It's fighting the gender binary, right?
Yeah.
Well, I love clothes and I love like creative clothing and I love thrift stores and vintage stores. So from the time I was in high school, I've always like gone and I loved like the punk rock scene and the new wave scene. And I mean, I've never been a fashionista because I'm not great at visualizing that. But I just basically figured out when I was younger that I wasn't going to be able to wear dresses and feel comfortable and have them look good. So I started just like shopping in at Hot Topic or in men's departments or putting together something that worked for me and not trying to be, you know, hemmed in and then trying to like find interesting ways of like having it be male clothing, but with like a female sort of touch to it. Right.
Yeah. Like you've always had long hair.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So like, or just like bling, you know, like, so you have a male-ish shirt, but you get, you know, you have it studded with bling all over it, or it's a picture of Marilyn Monroe or whatever, you know, cause I don't look good in traditional women's clothing. I don't feel comfortable in it, but I don't want to be completely in, I want it to be more creative than that. So it's like punk rock formal kind of, you know?
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, you know, now it's like, since my kid was born, it's hard to me to always get it together. I'm serious. Like it's just no time, you know? But yeah, I don't know. I tried to find a space for myself, right? And like, so for a while I would like try to do vests and ties, but in a way that was a little different maybe. And for a while, you know, I have like these Western shirts. Like what I do is I find some store or something that's off the beaten path, like some creative store. And then I really focus on what that designer is doing for a while. So like, there's like a store in Tucson where the woman there, makes like Western shirts, but puts weird things on them, like unicorns and aliens.
Yeah.
You know, so I bought like a bunch of shirts from her, and, you know, for a while I just intermixed that kind of stuff. Or there was like a store in Seattle for a while that had like these really great punk rock kind of clothes, but they were sort of more formal. So I would buy, you know, things there, just a few things. You don't have to spend a lot of money, and then use like thrift store stuff to kind of work into it. So like an interesting tie or belt or like, you know, some weird, like I like to wear patterns that work against each other and stuff like that, you know, because it's just more fun.
Learn just by trying things out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, also, like, you look at Mac, I don't like spend my time doing that, but if I'm in a dentist office and there's a GQ, you know, I'll look through it.
You look through the GQ.
You know, yeah. Or like punk rock people, I always, or like, and like the store Hot Topic, like that's a great store to kind of like still look at as like a.
You still roll into Hot Topic?
Yeah. I tell them I'm shopping for my nephew. I really do. Yeah. If they look at me weird, but I also do it online. A lot of times they won't have anything, but every now and then they'll have like this one thing that like Rude put out and designed, and it's like super cool. Right. And they'll only have it for like a week, and you catch it, you know, like plaid bondage pants. All right, I gotta have those, you know. And then I'll wear them for 5 years, you know.
I mean, do you see yourself as like this fashion icon?
No, God, no. No, you know what I see myself as is someone that like says to women, straight and gay, but that are more, that want to dress more masculine, that it's okay to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and you can still be sexy and feminine in that. Like that's what I can see happen. Like I know a kid that's like, I think she's 14 and she's the daughter of a friend of mine, and she's just struggling with her gender, right? And she could be straight, but masculine. You know, mm-hmm. She's just struggling. She wears dresses and she's just bummed about it. So she like saw me like on some video. She'd never seen me. She saw me on some video for like July 4th or something. And I think I was wearing like a vest and a tie and some kind of cool pants or something. And she like told her mom, that's what I want to dress like. And it's not about me at that point. It's like her figuring out that that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like seeing, I don't know what that actress's name that I love so much. I'm trying to remember her name. But anyway, then she came home and she went to, you know, whatever, off Saks, the outlet place that near my house or 30 minutes from my house, and bought like some men's stuff. Cause she said that to me, how do I find that clothes? Cause she didn't even know. It didn't even occur to her parents because they don't know either. Cause they're just struggling to try to figure out what's going to make her happy.
Right.
Right.
They don't get her to go to sleep,
and they don't mind her exploring in any way that she wants.
Yeah.
And so I said, just go to the men's store at like Macy's or something, like when they're having a sale, and like just do something that you've never, don't try to buy women's clothing. Just try to do that and see what happens. And she totally like bought like all this stuff. And I saw some pictures of her at a wedding, and it was like, you know, a vest, a tie, you know, like she looked really good.
Yeah.
And her hair was like, she chopped off the sides and made like a mohawk. And I was like, see?
That's
you
cool.
know, and that's like a liberating, you know, it's not about fashion.
Totally.
Yeah, at all. It's just like, how can she be what she is?
Do you want to talk about church camp?
Sure.
Okay.
Where you discover all the great things in life.
Right. I want to hear about your experience going to church camp, because it seems like everybody I talk to, like I've had friends who go to fiddle camp and music camp, and I went to 4-H camp, and it was huge part of my life. So I wanted to hear what it was like for you, and also like the singing at camp, what that was like for you, because when I go to an Indigo Girls concert, I'm like, this is summer camp. And I don't know if it has anything to do with that.
For me, it does. Emily, I don't know if Emily went to church camp. You can ask her about it, because she was more in a liberal, her dad, like a liberal theologian. I'm more of like the Methodist, Southern Methodist church camp girl, you know. I went to a camp up near where I live, actually, for 4 years, Camp Glisten. And I went to another camp called Camp Westminster. But Camp Glisten was my real formative, like, regular summer camp. And then we also did church camp with my youth group. So I went all the time. So we called those, like, youth retreats, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, just they were really intimate. And so I had a real problem with, like, authority, you know, and I really questioned authority. And my youth counselors let me do that, you know, and they really let me bump up against them and stuff. And I had for a while, I had a youth minister that had been a chaplain in the Army. And he was, and he just passed away last year. And he was a very good friend. And he was probably one of the most formative people in my life.
Wow.
Because he watched me growing up and didn't try to correct me, but he was protecting me. So when I went through, like, you know, buying drugs from people in the streets or whatever I did when I went to church on Friday nights, you know, and I did all these, you know, that was my way of, like, being safe and experimenting. You know, so church camp was the same way. Like, I would go to church camp and we would, you know, take a bottle of wine and, like, go in the woods and drink it, you know, or, like, talk about sex all night or read Forum magazine to each other, you know, and it's just, like, really, like,
but what's Forum magazine?
It's like a porn magazine.
Okay.
And you read stories that people have written about, like, so it's like, and if at that time, you know, it was probably pretty soft.
Yeah.
But you're 14, you know, and
yeah.
So you're into your puberty and you're, like, sharing this intimate space with your girls in your bunkhouse and the boys too. And it's a safe space because it's like, I don't know how to put it, but it's like, just, there's so much love and there's so much, like, good intention, because the thing about Christianity that was so great for me then was, like, I truly was trying to learn what I thought was the gospel of Jesus, which was, like, all about love and non-judgmentalness. And mm-hmm. I truly was, like, into the rebellion of Jesus as, like, an icon to me. I had a filter that sort of filtered the patriarchy out, you know?
Yeah.
I never thought about
good
that.
Work.
I didn't. I just yeah. was like, and then I was a religion major, you know, so I studied mm-hmm. a lot of different faiths and realized a lot of things about the patriarchy. But so Jesus was, like, this thing for me that was more Southern and about, like, and pastoral and sharing your gifts and feeding the community and sharing peace. And so church camp was like that too. And then we would sing, you know, everybody, my counselors always had guitars, always had a guitar of, like, from the time I was 10, and the chords were really easy. So you could sing these songs like Pass It On, or they'll know we are Christians by our love, or, like, Kumbaya, or Where Have All the Flowers Gone, or Cat Stevens songs, or Paul Simon songs. And a lot of songs I learned, like, I still have my church book, which is just, like, songs that are, like, Christian approved, I guess. You know what I mean? There's, like, a big yeah, fish yeah. on it. But it's all by, like, Cat Stevens and John Denver and Carole King. And, you know, it's all songs like that. And so that's what you do. You yeah. make crafts and you sit around and sing songs to each other and you put plays on, you know, like you. So I also went to choir camp, which was.
Oh, man.
You go and you learn a choir, like a musical, while you're gone. Yeah. And
was
my choir director.
Was it girls and boys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my choir director is, like, totally creative. And I still keep in touch with her. And she would, like, write these crazy, like, musicals, right?
Yeah.
And we would learn those and then go back and perform at the church. And they were Christian and everything. But, like, you know, like, for a while, I was very, like, I was pro-life and I was, like, really, like, conservative, even though I thought all about all this, like, rebellion stuff, right?
Yeah.
Pro-life was important to me because I was, like, feeling, you know, because there was, like, 1 year we had this youth minister that was terrible before the good ones. And he was, like, showing us, like, movies of, like, abortions. It was terrible.
Oh, wow.
And I was, like, so shocked because I'm all this, like, I'm into, like, pet welfare and baby welfare. Like, I'm into, like, taking care of the innocent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it made me totally pro-life. And then, like, it didn't take but, like, a year for me to, like, realize that that was, you know, kind of, like, not right at
yeah.
all.
There's propaganda.
Yeah, exactly. And I was mad at my church, at that church minister. He left, at that youth minister. Yeah. And so then we had the good one, and everything changed for me, right?
Yeah.
But that's how influential church was for me.
Totally.
You know? But I was starting to realize that I was different, too. You know, I was a tomboy, and, you know, I'm coming. And I really idolized, like, the older girls in the group. And, like, church camp gave us a chance to all be together. So mm-hmm. I got to be with, like, my, you know, 3 years older than me, tomboy mentor, you know, and I could watch and learn. And I didn't realize what was happening in me, but it was happening, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like a couple of people that were really like influential. One of them died when we were really like, when we were young, like when we were like, I was like 17 and that was hard for me, but yeah, so it, church camp was, yeah, it was like the source for me of like a lot of what I am now, basically.
I get
exploring
that.
And like nature and freedom, you know, and like just rules just don't matter at all.
Yeah.
But in a safe space.
Yeah, totally. Seems like we're going to have to pick this up at another time.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sorry, I'm long-winded.
So. No. I've got a lot of things I'd like to talk to you about. So maybe like part two in the future.
Yeah. Totally.
Great.
Totally.
Thank you so much for doing
this.
Yes. Thank
you.
Appreciate it so much.
I love talking to Amy Ray. She's been on Basic Folk twice. One of my favorite people to talk to. Next up, we're going to talk to Emily Saliers, who was also really incredible to speak with. I first asked her about her relationship with her guitar playing, tracing it back to her childhood lessons at the YMCA and also musical members of her family. She also points out how playing electric guitar changed the game for her, particularly through collaborations with Amy Ray. Emily talks about her first solo album, Murmuration Nation, that was released in 2017. So the album actually took a long time to get out due to challenges and emotional hurdles that she faced during the process. Lyris Hung, longtime Indigo Girls friend, collaborator, and producer, including Emily's solo album, brought her expansive musical imagination and played a critical role in shaping the record. We also get into Emily's love for hip-hop, specifically political hip-hop, and the profound impact the genre has had on her. Emily gets into her other great love of food by drawing parallels between the communal nature of music and food, illustrating how both bring people together in meaningful ways. Let's get into it. This is my conversation with Emily Saliers on Basic Folk.
So I want to talk about your guitar playing to start off with, if that's all right.
Sure.
And from my perspective, I don't know how you feel about it. You've inspired like generations of guitar players. And I was wondering what your relationship with your guitar playing was like.
Well, I don't know about inspiring generations of guitar players. I mean, it's always, you can always be better. You know, you play, you know, more fluently than some and much less fluently than others. I was just recently watching a YouTube video of Mark Knopfler. And I was like, oh my gosh. I would have had to start a long time ago. But when I found guitar, I was 9 years old. It was lessons at the YMCA. I came from a musical family, so we had tried different instruments. But there was something about the guitar that was compelling to me. Maybe because I had a cousin who was a professional guitarist, performer. But at any rate, I started lessons at the Y, and from the second I put a guitar in my hand, that was it. That was my instrument, and not only my instrument, but it was my vehicle for getting my feelings out, for writing songs. I could take it with me, and I did everywhere. And so it became a very, very personal relationship from the very beginning. I really couldn't put it down. I loved it, loved playing all the time. I could hear by ear pretty well songs. So if I heard a song, I could figure out the chords pretty easily. I remember learning Diamonds and Rust at a young age. And I don't know whether I fingered it the way Joan did, but I played it close enough so that I could play the song. And that was very satisfying to me to learn how to play songs by ear. And so, you know, I also took classical guitar lessons when I was 11 for 2 years. Mostly my dad wanted me to.
Yeah, how'd that go?
It was great for my technique. And some of the things I played when I was 11, I can't even believe it because I try to play them now. I remember some of the finger and I can't do it. I mean, I practiced a lot and it was much more of a discipline and I read music. So it was very, very immersed, almost like learning a language and really, really knowing it. So it was quite... like improving and growing rapidly for those 2 years. And then I quit classical and just kept up at my own pace. But I love guitar playing. I love it more than singing, really.
Yeah.
and getting to play electric guitar now. Like, if I'd never hooked up with Amy, I probably wouldn't be playing electric guitar. She has that rock side. Mm. And she always encouraged me to play electric guitar. So, but I still feel like a very, very baby electric guitar player.
So when you made your solo record, it was your first solo, it's been your first solo record ever, and you had to overcome a lot of fear, and it was very brave to do a solo album so different than anything you'd done with Amy. Wondering how that experience emboldened you and how it might have been a painful experience, if at all.
A lot of it was painful. I mean, it was like, I think because it was my first, I suppose it's like a parent's having their first child and being anxious about what to do and to do it right and how to do it and how to create a good environment for the kid. It was like, what kind of environment am I going to create for this album? I mean, it's just an album in the end. It's not as important as human life or anything. Sure, yeah. But I think because it was my first, I put a lot of pressure on myself. Luckily, Lyris Hung produced it, and she's just has an incredible breadth of musical knowledge and just a musical imagination that just knows no end. It's so expansive. And so I plugged into her, you know, her brilliance, and she really took me on a ride. So I wrote the songs. We co-wrote one. But the process was different. It's not like I wrote them through and played them all on guitar, and then that's how we put them on the album. Mm-hmm. Lyris really wanted to put certain parts in certain places, fill in the space rather than strumming through a song all the way. I may play a guitar, a little part here, or a guitar part here. So some of my learning curve was trying to perform those songs live without a band and having them transfer from that.
Yeah.
And I had a very difficult time. And in fact, I don't really play. I play one song from that album live a lot, and that's Train Inside, because I actually recorded that by playing it through on this on the song. But it was more important for Lyris to put pieces in it. And I think a lot of times you get a better record if you do that. You get a better album. I mean, better is not a great word choice, but it's more expansive. And there's something about strumming through a song is fine, or picking through a song, but it takes up a lot of the frequencies in one area. But if you patch things with different sonic frequencies, instrument textures and stuff, you end up with a completely different canvas at the end. That was exciting, but it was a struggle. I was insecure. You know, it also turns out it was the season before I got my appendix out. So my health was not great. I didn't realize how it was affecting my spirit. So there were just some things in there. I did a Pledge Music campaign that the fans were incredibly supportive.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of work, lots and lots of work. And so it was a great undertaking for me. The next one will be so much more relaxed.
Oh, good.
So much more relaxed. Yeah.
So now that you're working on another Indigo Girls album, is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah. What can you say about how your solo project and that solo experience is affecting this new record with Amy?
Really good question. I mean, I'm much more relaxed in the studio now. I kind of have a feeling of whatever comes up. Like, I believe in practicing and focusing and working out some parts. But now a lot of times I really believe in just what comes in the moment could be the best part. And I'm also quite focused now on putting things in spaces rather than on top of things. So that was definitely an influence with working with Lyris and doing a solo album.
Did she have you do any, like, it's so interesting to hear you talk about, like, putting things in spaces and sort of just, like, taking things as they come. Like, was there any, like, non-musical practices that she would have you participate in to sort of expand your subconscious?
No, but we had a lot of conversations.
Yeah.
Not practices, but she just was very, very firm and confident in the fact that these songs would translate however they were performed. I never got to that leap where I could play any of these very, very produced songs on guitar. I think I missed the sonic breadth.
Like a lack of control over how things were sounding?
Well, more like if I just play this on an instrument and play through it, it didn't feel as satisfying. It didn't feel, the only incarnation I knew the songs in was to have them produced in a way that was very full. Incredible drummers, you know, bass player, players, all these instrumentalists who introduced that music to me. And so mm-hmm. then when it was just me and an instrument, it was like, blah, I can't do this. Oh. But we had lots of conversations about how they could translate and that a song was just as valid in one incarnation as in another. And Lyris just also talked about the importance of finding space for things rather than just jamming it all together. I wanted to have more beats on the solo album, more, and she really, I wrestled her to the ground for a couple of actual machine beats, but in the end, she wanted the drummers to emulate the beats, so play them by a human rather than by a machine. And I gave into that, I'm glad, for the most part.
So we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the Indigo Girls self-titled album. I think it's February 28th.
Oh.
Yeah. So I've read and heard many times that Joni Mitchell says that she developed new connections to her songs as she grew older. Does that ring true for you on these songs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, Closer to Fine, for instance, from that album. I wrote that when I was, I guess, just around the end of college or maybe slightly post-college. And I was in a completely different frame of mind. And so all those words and that searching for this and that, not finding the answers in one thing, was very, very important for me to write about back then. Mm-hmm. And now that song is just like a hootenanny sing-along, you know. And it is, I take it more like, you know, just chill. Don't worry so much. Don't dig so hard. But there are other songs that really, really, they kind of, they latch on to what's going on in my life at the time. Mm-hmm. And if they're written so that they're not so specific that they just tie me to that one time, but they're universal enough in human experience that they can last through the years and then I can, my current experience as me latches onto them. And the same thing with Amy's songs. And so that's cool. Because it keeps them fresh. And there are some songs, I just don't like them anymore. So we just don't play them.
Right.
But the other ones that go all the way back still have a life of their own.
Yeah. That must be cool to like write a song, like to keep revisiting a song 30 years later and be like, hey, this is a pretty good song.
Well, I never think that. I always think it. There's a couple songs where I'm like, this is a good song. I don't know where this came from, but this I know this is a good song.
Yeah.
You know? And then there are others. Most of the rest of them where I'm like, oh, I could have tweaked this line. I could have done this. I could have done that. But I think that's just like what creators do.
Yeah.
Everybody does it.
Yeah. You know, the artist's condition. Yeah.
They're not even artists, but I think even people in other lines of work do the same thing. Just scrutinize their work and how it could have been better. What could have been different.
Totally. So I was lucky enough to work in Pittsburgh with Rosemary Welsh at WIP. Do you know her?
We probably do because we've spent a lot of time in Pittsburgh playing.
So I know she's introduced Indigo Girls on stage a couple times and has interviewed you. But she's been at the station for 37 years and she and I worked together for over 11 years. We like sat next to each other and she just was like a mentor for me, gave me so much like personal and professional advice. And she also talked to me a lot about what it was like to be a woman in her 50s in the radio industry, and not just the radio industry, but the world. And she talked about how women her age start to become invisible to the world. And you're a little younger than her, but and have a more like public profile, so it might be different for you. But how do you see that to be true? And if it is, how do you handle it?
I definitely think it's true. I think that a lot of that is based on sexism. There's just a lack of respect and value for women past a certain point once they can't be sexualized in the same way. And we have like societal norms on how older men age beautifully, but older women do not. And, you know, all this bullshit about the drive of the man and how it's got to go after this or that, you know, just crap that we've been made to believe. Well, I don't believe it, but so I think that that is a societal problem, that women as they age become invisible. Now on the personal and the small microcosmic level, those who are in community with older women know that women mentors are invaluable. We can't do without them. I've had women like you've had with Rosemary that have mentored me in that way. So there you have the like massive macro societal problems with the way that women are valued, especially if they can't be objectified and fit into that paradigm mm-hmm. that's male and has to do with the heteronormative paradigm, really. So for me, like, well, Amy and I had Caroline Aiken. She was a little bit older than we were. She was playing at this bar called Good Old Days. She was an established local artist, had also toured. She shared her set with us. She took us under her wing. She was gracious, generous, always let us sit in with her or let me sing a song during her set. Stuff that you never forget. And now women like Winona LaDuke, the great Native American activist leader from Minnesota, from the White Earth Reservation, who Amy and I have become friends with. So these women that we know, like, you can't live without your mentors, especially your women mentors, because mm-hmm. women are still, we don't have the power. We have our own kind of power, a spirit power and an energy power that's undeniable and I think frightening to a lot of men. But we don't have the power in business and the power in decision-making. The power, politics is getting better. So I think it's true that women become invisible, but not across the board. So it's one of those things where the strength is not completely under the radar, but really informing the lives of those of us who plug into that
yeah.
and believe in that.
I get that. All right, let's talk about rap music.
Yes! Yes!
So you are a big hip-hop fan. You're drawn to the brilliance of the rhythms in hip-hop. You really identify with political hip-hop.
Yeah.
The rhythmic center and the powerful messages. Can you define what you mean by political hip-hop?
I would say political hip-hop is, you know, hip-hop with a message that pertains to social issues, so or political issues or societal issues. So like very early on, Public Enemy, I would call them a political hip hop. I mean, they had some songs that weren't, but, you know, Chuck D was talking about the inequality for black people, about black prisons, about how people get afraid when everybody else gets a gun. But when a black man gets a gun, there's a problem with it. All these songs, she watched Channel Zero, you know, about the bad effects of television and what gets shown on that. Just Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back was a brilliant album. That's political rap. Talib Kweli is political rap, you know. Rage Against the Machine, political rap. And I'm probably not thinking of a million different, you know, KRS-One back in the day. And, of course, Tupac. Hugely political in a lot of his stuff. Not all of his songs, but I think it's like Indigo Girls were political in some, but not all.
Right.
Or considered a political band.
So recently I took a pretty deep dive into hip hop at my radio station and also became a huge fan of hip hop too, but grappled with a lot of topics of, you know, gun violence, drugs, violence towards women, and thinking about these things are symptoms of systematic issues. So how do we wrap our heads around that violence? Like, how do you grapple with the importance of the message, but deal with the criticism in certain parts of the message?
I have a really hard time with that myself. I think the first thing, like, some of it is just intolerable. The misogyny, the way women are spoken of in some contemporary hip hop. I mean, it's just, I remember when Queen Latifah came out with UNITY and she's like, who are you calling a bitch? You know, because that word bitch, I can't stand that word. For me, I can never take it back. As much as we try to use it in a certain way, if you look at the origins of that word and how it was used to demean women and still is in every way. But Queen Latifah back then was like, you know, pointing a finger at that misogyny. And that song was very important for me. She was very important for me as a hip hop artist because the content of her lyrics and what she explored. But anyway, I struggle daily with that. I mean, and what I try to do is be discerning about what's absolute glorification of violence and guns. And there are some like gangster rappers who have not lived that life. We're just, you know, producing this music and the content of these lyrics that doesn't reflect their own experience fully. And that's just glorification, you know? And there are other rap artists who talk about those artists as well. And then the other thing is that I try not to judge it based on my experience as a privileged white person. Mm-hmm. So if there's someone like, you know, well, Young Thug, I'm a huge fan of his. So if you don't even have to study his background, but you have to know that he grew up with a very hard life, you know, underprivileged life, always was in trouble, lost his brother to violence. And yet he's incredibly creative, sensitive, beautiful man, from what I can tell from his music. One of my songs that I die over his, that is from his album Slime Language, and it's called Oh Yeah. And that album included a bunch of his family on it. He's just all about family. He's like, why should I know anybody else? I've got 100 family members that I love. Anyways, his sister sings on it. And the language is, I'm the one who gave you this piece of jewelry and, you know, Gucci shirt on and good pussy, good jeans, you know. And he's talking a lot about material things that he's given to this woman. And so those are not the lyrics that I would write from my own experience. Mm-hmm. I don't have the same value on jewelry or, but I can't judge what gifts from one person from a different orientation in life means. And then I hear his voice and the way he sings it and raps it and then the beat. I mean, I'm going on and on about this one song, but I think my point is, there's a lot of these rap and hip hop artists who are really singing their experience, and it's really different from mine. But as far as the misogyny goes, I can never accept it. You know, I can take the music for what it is, but when it comes to a line that's completely degrading to women, you know, I don't care really how people in those communities think about women, but I'm never going to be able to say, you know, in terms of morality or ethics or just basic human compassion, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you've got an artist like Kendrick Lamar, who's amazing and respects women, and Tupac respected women, and a gazillion rap artists who respect women. Mm-hmm. So it's a mixed bag, like anything.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a really delicate conversation to try to have as like people who are outside of like who basically are like guests in the hip hop world.
I can't speak for any of it. I'm very, very, you know, I mean, I just, who knows what I just said that took so long, but I'm very, very cognizant of the fact that I'm white, I'm privileged. I cannot make any judgment or, you know, I just love the music. And I love so much of the content.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's incredibly intelligent genre, very misunderstood.
I think.
So it's great that you are advocating for it in your circle.
Yeah.
Okay, food.
Yay.
Food is an important topic in your life. You have a restaurant in Atlanta called Watershed. What has been your relationship to food from growing up to now, and how do you see music and food intersecting?
Well, actually, we just sold Watershed last year, so we had it for almost 20 years, and someone else bought it. So now I'm out of the restaurant business currently.
How does it feel?
You know, it feels fine. There was a time where I was intent on going to the very finest restaurants and, but the finest restaurants as well are like, there's this stretch in Atlanta called Buford Highway, and there's like restaurant communities from all over the world. And so their food is represented in mostly like these little dives. There's no atmosphere at all except for the energy of the people eating there.
Yeah.
So I was never a snob about food, but there was a time when it was very important for me to eat fine food. And that's just not the case anymore. I'm grateful to have something like that, but I don't really want to spend as much money on it anymore. I'm just focused on different things. But I've been a foodie since I was a kid. My sister and I, if we were having a good meal, we would talk about what we were going to have next week. And I was addicted to fried clams at Howard Johnson's. When my family used to take road trips, I would get permission to eat them for breakfast when everyone else was eating eggs. And I just always have loved food and thought about food. And so when Amy and I had a little break in our schedule a gazillion years ago, and I had these partners and we wanted to do something and we were all foodies, and so we decided to have a restaurant. But I think that food and music and the way they bring people together is very, very similar. You have the regional quality of food. So, you know, the way certain Southern music takes you right down south. Mm. And without even knowing it intimately, it can speak to a region. And it's the same way with food that's prepared, that's regional. Also, I believe in things in their own seasonal time, you know. So you wait until the weather gets warm before you have the perfect strawberry or the perfect watermelon, and, you know, peas in the spring or fava beans and root vegetables in the fall. And so it becomes very cyclical and almost like ritualistic in a way. And I think that music is something that has to come in its own time. When it's ready, there's timing involved. Mm. There's seasons of life that are reflected in it. So I just think there are countless. And, you know, the way you sit around a table with a bunch of people who are into sharing food. So music is shared, like food is shared. And sometimes sports is the same way. Brings people together. Yeah. To... unless they're angry about their team losing, you know. But it's food and music mostly that are,
yeah,
you know, kissing cousins like that.
Yeah. I remember my uncle and aunts lived in Atlanta, Powder Springs, Georgia, for a little while. And we would go visit them, and we went to Varsity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't drink carbonated beverages. And I asked for, like, a cup of water. And they were like, what? I'm sorry, what?
Don't you mean a Coke?
Yeah. Ginger ale? No, it's not water. But
yeah. Well, fuzzy drinks. Yeah. Sugary drinks.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been so great to talk. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me on your podcast. You're excellent. That's obvious.
Thank you.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is produced by The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out on basicfolk.com, folkalley.com, or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app, or you can listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, perhaps you should send it to everyone that you know, because everyone loves the Indigo Girls. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Bye.